Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program looking into the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, all of that sort of thing. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach now at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for a variety of outlets, including truthout.org. Truthout.org is an independent source of news and information and analysis daily. With enthusiasm, I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. We also maintain two websites that I want to invite you to make use of. They're available free 24/7. They contain the kinds of information and links and articles, classes, lectures, interviews, of the sort that we explore on this program. So if you like this program, the chances are you will find useful items in these websites. The first one is rdwolf with two F's, .com. And the second one is democracyatwork.info. In addition to those benefits, two other things are available on these websites. First, both of them provide you with a way of communicating with us, telling us what you like, what you'd like to see on these programs, what you don't like, questions you'd like answered. We appreciate the enormous flood of mail we've been getting. We use it to shape this program, but we ask your understanding that we can't answer all the questions. There simply is not enough time, even in an hour-long program, as this is. The other thing you can do on both websites is click on an icon and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, which we likewise urge you to do to keep in a more regular contact with our program and our activities. Let's turn then to the updates. Here we are in September of 2014, and there are three quick ones that I want to get out of the way at the beginning because they're important in different ways. First, there's a new report out from the Department of Agriculture in the United States. Every year, they do an annual survey to check on what they call food insecurity in the United States. What they define as food insecurity is this, and I'll quote, "The share of American households that lacked access to adequate food at some point during the last year," that would be 2013. And here's what they report. Back in the years 2006 and 7, the years before the current crisis hit, food insecurity was in the 11% range. And what that means is one out of nine American households had limited access to adequate food. Friends, that's a fairly severe standard. It means you didn't have enough to eat. One out of nine. When the crisis hit in 2008 and right through 2013, that number jumped to over 14%, or one out of seven American households. It has not gone appreciably down since it jumped in the year 2008. 14.6% in 2008, 14.3% in 2013. Why do I stress this? Besides wanting to make sure that we all understand that we live in a country where one out of seven families has food insecurity, I also wanted to stress two other things. One, these statistics show that there's no recovery. We haven't gone back to the 11% of 2006 and 7, lamentable as that is. We haven't done that. We've stayed at 14%. So if you look at a statistic like this, there is no recovery. A point I've been making in recent weeks, that there are many statistics about our economic performance. If you choose to look at those that point upward, you can talk about a recovery. But then the question is, for whom are they pointing up? And the answer has been shareholders, top executives, the one, the top five, the top 10%. If you look at other statistics, like those affecting one out of seven American families with food insecurity, there's no recovery at all. The next update you might call a falling out among thieves, and that can sometimes be instructive. Back in 2010, as I'm sure most of you will remember, oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico exploded. It tended to get the name of one of them, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. Many companies were involved in the steps that led to this explosion. The explosions distributed oil across the Gulf of Mexico and did tens of billions of dollars worth of damage to the coastline, to the fishing and tourism industries, not to speak of the damage done to the health of animals and human beings that is still being tabulated. A bunch of companies were clearly involved. Halliburton, the famous company once led by former Vice President Cheney, an oil services company, the Anadarko Petroleum Company, the big one, BP, which used to stand for British Petroleum, and the Transocean Drilling Company, to mention the major players. They've been in court ever since doing two things. One, trying to undermine the claims made by Gulf of Mexico towns, fishermen, citizens, for some kind of damages to be paid to them for all that they suffered. And they've been fighting against that in court. And then the companies have been fighting one another. Who will pay the fines that government agencies will levy? Who will pay the court costs and the claims of all those whom they damaged? Over the last week, Halliburton finally cut a deal with the government to pay $1.1 billion. But they also blamed everybody else, just as everybody else blamed them. One of the reasons Halliburton had to settle a $1.1 billion fine was that they were earlier convicted. Let me make sure you all get this. They were earlier convicted because Halliburton pleaded guilty to a criminal charge of destroying evidence in these lawsuits last year. What a pretty picture. But here's, in a sense, the lesson to be drawn. In the United States of today, when private enterprises like those I've just mentioned cause catastrophic damage in the tens of billions of dollars lasting into an indefinite future, what we have is finger pointing among them, very small fines. I might mention that I checked the stock market on the day, September 2nd, that Halliburton was settled that fine for $1 billion. The stock barely moved, dipped down for a couple of hours, and ended up $67.50 a share. It had opened the day at $68 a share. Nobody invested in Halliburton is worried. This is a small, inconsequential slap on the wrist. So the lesson is, not much is done to the companies that do this. A lot of finger-pointing delays the monies that are desperately needed by all whom they hurt. And the biggest lesson of all, why is there not a cry that goes up that says, what in the world are we doing fining small fines, watching these people blame each other, watching them use every legal gimmick in the book to shift the burden from one to the other and to avoid paying the many whom they've hurt? Why isn't the cry going up, these are far too important and far too risky ventures to leave in the hands of private enterprises since they work like this? One line of argument might be that the government ought to take over something this important and this dangerous for so many people, given the lamentably poor performance of these private companies. But even better would be, why don't we make these companies genuine cooperatives where all the workers and the local communities have a real powerful democratic say in what these companies do, how much they spend for all the protection that these communities need, who they scrimp with, Who's making money here? This is something everybody should know because of a lot of different players. The workers, the managers, the community served had a say in all of this. There'd be a lot better chance that we wouldn't get this kind of dysfunction. But in America today, that option, state involvement, co-op transformation, keeps being kept off the table by the folks who run these private companies and want the freedom to keep doing what they've been doing. Last quick update has to do with the former Republican House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor. He announced over the last week that having lost the primary in his state of Virginia, which there was a lot of attention for, he's taking a job at the investment bank Moelis & Company, M-O-E-L-I-S. And they will pay him, according to Bloomberg, on the 2nd of September, at least $3.4 million in his first year. Wow. Mr. Cantor goes, as so many have, from his job at the top of a political party to his job at the top of the economic pyramid that runs the American economy. And that led me to think about who else has been doing this, since there's no point in picking on Mr. Cantor. He's really not doing something all that different from plenty of other folks. And there I got an interesting assist from Daryl Delamide, or maybe it's Delamade, who wrote in the September 2nd USA Today newspaper an excellent story. And here's a list of some of the other people that he wanted to talk about. Timothy Geithner used to be the Treasury Secretary. He joined Warburg Pincus, a private equity firm, where he will earn, of course, millions. Wow. But there are others. Lanny Breuer, former Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division, who found countless reasons not to prosecute any bankers in the wake of the crisis. This is Delamide's story in the USA Today. He, that is Lanny Breuer, joined the corporate law firm of Covington and Burling, which bills many of those bankers millions for legal advice, end quote. The article also refers to Mary Shapiro, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, who recently joined Promontory Financial Group, a Wall Street consulting firm. Wow. Kathleen Casey, a Republican appointee to the Securities and Exchange Commission, recently joined the board of HSBC, one of the largest banks in the world based in London. And he ends the story, Mr. Delamade does, by referring to Hillary Clinton, who has been collecting, he says, speaking fees of upwards of $200,000 per speech from the likes of Goldman Sachs. It is, of course, a reasonable question, long asked by knowledgeable folks. If the people in government come from, and even more, expect to go back to, lucrative multi-million-dollar-a-year jobs in Wall Street, can we reasonably expect them to be super hawks governing Wall Street, regulating Wall Street, supervising Wall Street? If they did so, what would that do to their job prospects, all those connections they need? Think about it. I always like periodically also in these updates to tell you about how the other half lives. And so I found very interesting a story I learned this week about Israel Englander, a hedge fund operator, who, by the way, founded Millennium Management LLC back in 1989. It now manages over $23 billion, which it invests for rich people. And Mr. Englander was the sixth highest earning hedge fund manager last year in 2013, making, according to Bloomberg on the 2nd of September, in last year alone, $850 million. Well, As you think about that, you will realize that what I'm about to tell you comes as not much of a surprise. He just purchased an apartment, 740 Park Avenue in New York City. He purchased it from the government of France, which used to own it. And in doing so, this duplex apartment, it covers two floors, he paid $71.3 million, a record price for a Manhattan co-op. He lives in a building then that used to be the home of such folks as John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. He already owns another apartment in that building, according to the records. It may be the case, as you're going to learn later in this program, that millions of Americans have severe housing problems. No place to live, their houses worth less than the mortgage they're paying off on the house, and so on. But at the other end of this economy, it produces people who can and do buy a second apartment in the most expensive real estate on earth, pay 71 plus million for two floors. And if you think that's a successful and acceptable way for an economic system to work, then I don't think you've been paying attention. Last couple of updates have to do with an institution to which many have looked in the United States and elsewhere as a kind of institution that will help, quote unquote, level the playing field. This goes back to an old idea, old in, around the world and in the United States as well. The idea goes something like this. Everybody should start sort of equal. We should all start life with the same resources, the same supports, so that we can discover and develop our skills, our aptitudes, our passions, and so become as productive as possible for the communities in which we live. We don't want people to be radically different in what they have to start out life. We shouldn't have some people with not enough to eat, like we saw, or not enough basic supports to have the time, to have the energy, to learn what their skills are and to develop them, while other people are billionaires and can have 27 tutors and every support imaginable. That would be an unequal opportunity society, which many of us would not support. And this idea, very old, has led there to be an emphasis on two things, an inheritance tax and education. The idea of the inheritance tax is, okay, if you make a lot of money and you can enjoy it, but you can't leave it to your kids because that gives them a disproportionate and unfair advantage over other children who, through no fault of their own, were born into families that don't have all this money. This is an unfair advantage, and so an inheritance tax removes that, or at least lessens it. And the second idea that societies have used, and by the way, many countries, including the United States, have inheritance taxes for precisely this reason. But the other institution are schools. The idea is, okay, we do as much as we can to even people's economic resources, hopefully, but there are still inequalities. The person who becomes rich in his or her lifetime can give unfair advantages to their kids while they're alive, even with an inheritance tax. But the other institution is schooling. We're supposed to give help to the schools that need it most, to use the schools as a way to help the disadvantaged catch up, in a sense, develop their skills, develop their intelligence, their capability, and so on, so that they have a roughly equal chance. And there were two reports over the last week to indicate how that's going. And again, I assume most of you will not be surprised to learn it's not going real well. One report had to do with school funding here in the United States, and it reminded me of a story from 2013 done by Eduardo Porter, a columnist for the New York Times, that basically found that across the United States, in most states, there isn't extra money going to the schools in the poorest neighborhoods to compensate them. In fact, many states give more money because of the way schools are funded, usually by local property taxes. If you live in a richer town, the property is worth more, the tax on property raises more, so we actually spend more on the children of families in rich areas than we do on the children of families in poor. And even in the few states that try to offset that, that give more state money to poor districts than rich, the evidence shows that what they give is nowhere near enough to overcome the gap that still exists between rich and poor. To make a long story short, in the United States, not only do we not offset unequal opportunity for young people in our schools, we actually make it worse by giving more money to the kids who need it least than we give to the kids who need it most. Finally, a report from Great Britain to show that the United States is in no way unique. The Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission in Great Britain, a government agency, has just issued a report to which the title given by the government in its own publications is Elitist Britain with a question mark. There's much in this report I would recommend, published on the 28th of August, 2014. But quickly, to bring you up to date, here's what they found. England has a public school system and a public university system. That's where the overwhelming majority of people go to school. What they call private or independent schools below university educate only about 7% of people. And the most famous private universities, Oxford and Cambridge, educate something on the order of 1% or 2% of the British people. In other words, tiny minority. But oh boy, is this the tiny minority that counts. These schools, educating, as I said, 7% of people below college and 1% or 2% of people above college, account for the following, according to the British government last month. 71% of senior judges in the legal system of Britain come from these schools. 53% of diplomats, 50% of members of the House of Lords, 44% of the Sunday London Times list of rich people, and so on, and so on, and so on. The report ends by saying things like, how can we have a society in which everybody feels a part of Britain if we create a situation where a tiny minority play such a disproportionately dominant role politically and economically? This question can and should be asked because that outcome is a product of the economic system in which we live, capitalism. And if you want to solve that problem, rather than having government or private reports every few years wringing their hands about this sad story, then you've got to do something about the system that keeps reproducing this kind of outcome. We turn next, as we always do in this program, to some larger issues that deserve some analysis. The first one I want to talk about is recent hoopla in the press, particularly the financial press, about shifting to a four-day week. That's right. Working people would be shifting from a five-day week, Monday through Friday, to a four-day week, Monday through Thursday. A very recent issue of Forbes magazine said its time has come for a four-day work week. The richest man in Mexico, Carlos Slim, usually credited with being the second richest man on Earth, is so excited about a four-day week that he has begun to talk about a three-day work week. Wow. A recent survey of American millionaires indicated that a majority of them think a four-day work week is a good idea. All right, what is going on, ladies and gentlemen? For most of the history of capitalism, employers have wanted more and more work out of their workers. They've wanted them to work 12, 14, 16 hours a day. The history of capitalism is the history of workers trying to get the working day reduced to 8 hours. One of the most famous demonstrations happened back in the 1880s in Chicago. A demonstration of workers in that city demanding laws that would prevent an employer from making a person work more than 8 hours a day, or at least requiring them to get the approval of the worker and to pay them an extra for more than 8 hours, what we now call overtime pay or time and a half pay, and so on. There was violence at that demonstration. Some people were arrested. Somebody was shot. Somebody was hurt. And it ended up becoming a holiday for workers around the world, called May Day, because it happened around May 1st. May Day. It's actually celebrated in most countries of the world, although not in the United States, which is ironic given that's where the demonstration that led to the holiday actually happened. My point is that workers have always been driven to work more and more and more hours. Many people on Wall Street complain that they work way more hours than they're legally supposed to, and that cry is echoed around the country. Fast food workers who are demonstrating these days across the country also complain often about being made to work hours for which they are not paid. So what is going on that employers are suddenly talking about shortening the work week? Well, let's take a look. First, let's be real clear. Employers do not want to pay workers the same while they work fewer hours. Make no mistake. Their desire is to pay the worker less money for less hours. What's going on? Well, some of the explanation for this, many of you have thought of. It turns out that lots of studies show that by the fifth day of the week, Friday, an awful lot of workers are sick and tired of the job, have been overstressed. Fridays are the days in which many people seem to develop mental and physical infirmities of various kinds. Productivity seems to drop for workers. Their attention is distracted, and so on. So one thing companies are saying to themselves is, we're not getting as much out of the worker on Friday as we get Monday through Thursday, so why don't we rearrange things and make somebody who come in to work Monday through Thursday and another one come in, say, work Tuesday through Friday. That way we get four better days, and we'll just pay workers for 4 days, not for five, so it isn't going to cost us any more money. Then there are those employers who think, wow, I can move to 4 days. I'll move up from 8 hours a day to 10 hours a day. That way I'll get the same 40 hours I used to get 5 days, 8 hours. I'll get in 4 days, 10 hours a day. So that's okay with me. I can then close the factory or the office on Fridays, save a lot of utility bills and other associated. I'll be ahead. I won't pay the workers a nickel more. I'll still get 40 hours out of them. But there's a deeper reason I want you to think about as to why this is happening. Why, suddenly, after a century and a half of capitalism's pushing workers to work more and more hours a day, more and more days a week, etc., why then suddenly this reversal? And I think the reason has to do with a basic change in capitalism that I talk to you about from time to time, but that bears repeating over and over again. Starting in the 1970s, something fundamental in capitalism changed. Up until that time, from the beginnings of capitalism as a dominant economic system in England in the 18th century, for the last 200 years, give or take, capitalism concentrated its production where it developed first, in Western Europe, in North America, and then in Japan. That's where the factories were concentrated. That's where the offices were concentrated. That's where the big cities housing factories and offices and stores were concentrated. The rest of the world was kind of a hinterland. The rest of the world, there wasn't much concern about. The rest of the world didn't have good jobs or any jobs at all. The wages in the rest of the world, the standard of living, dropped. even as the standard of living of the workers, organized into unions and political parties, was forced upward as they compelled the capitalist employers doing so well in Western Europe, North America, and Japan to give them a rising standard of living. By the 1970s, American capitalists, European capitalists, and Japanese capitalists became aware that the gap between the rising standard of living of the workers they were hiring, where they had grown up in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, compared to the wages of the mass of workers in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, the underdeveloped parts of the world, the gap was becoming enormous. And they looked longingly, the capitalists did, at the fantasy, up until the 1970s, of moving, getting production done not by the expensive workers in North America, Western Europe, and Japan, but by the much cheaper workers everywhere else in the world. But they couldn't do it because the costs and time and difficulties of traveling to those far parts of the world were too high, and it was impossible to monitor, to control, to take care of business far away. You had to be on top of it, and therefore it had to be nearby. And you were based in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, so you did your production there. But in the 1970s, two breakthroughs, the jet engine and modern telecommunications, the computer, long-distance electronic activity. Suddenly, it became possible in a matter of hours for a capitalist in Western Europe, North America, and Japan to get anywhere in the world. And by telecommunications, a capitalist in London could monitor what was happening in Bangladesh as closely as he could monitor something down the block. And so capitalists moved, and they brought in the millions of people that had been excluded from the world of capitalism because they had lived in Asia, Africa, Latin America. Now they were looking for jobs, and they got jobs. Capitalists suddenly had hundreds of millions, billions of new workers to deal with. And as they move, they're, as they've been doing for decades now, to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, particularly Eastern Europe, there are fewer and fewer jobs for those left at home. That's why unemployment is high in Western Europe, North America, and increasingly in Japan as well. So it's time to redivide the jobs. So they want to give less work to Americans. That's what the four-day week is about, to generalize the lower workforce, the less pay that's going to be given to Americans. It's part of the long-term decline of the original places capitalism grew up as capitalism moves away. It abandons the old areas, North America, Western Europe, and Japan, moves to new areas, and therefore says to the working people of North America, Western Europe, and Japan, we're not raising your standard of living. We're lowering it. And going from 5 to 4 days of work and paying you 20% less is part of that historic shift. We're now going to take our usual mid-program break. Please stay with me. We will be right back on Economic Update. This is, again, the second half of Economic Update. For today, I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And as usual, I want to remind you of our two websites where you can follow our work, rdwolff with two Fs.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of them are available to provide you free of charge with all that we do, and we update them multiple times a day. Both of them give you a chance to communicate with me and with our program staff here to make this program better, to try to answer your questions, and so on. And finally, both of those websites provide you with icons. Just click on them, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and thereby keep an even closer touch with the work that we do. The second big issue I want to spend a few minutes with you about is one that many of you have written to ask me about. You're wondering, in a sense, what happened to socialism. And the way you pose the question is, many of you know a good bit about it, some of you don't and want to know about it, but all of you seem to understand that for most of the history of capitalism, the big major alternative to it, particularly over the last 100, 200 years, has been socialism. And so to understand our capitalist system, it might be important to understand what happened to, what the story is, the history is, if you like, of socialism. So let me try, in the limited amount of time that we have for such things, to talk with you about that, to respond to your interest. Socialism is a kind of idea, set of ideas, that is, on the one hand, critical of capitalism, and on the other hand, is an idea about an alternative way of organizing society. So in a sense, it is critical of capitalism, the system we have, and offers an alternative. For most of the history of socialism, it has mostly done the first. That is, it has been critical of capitalism. It has really not had much of a chance to show what it could do as an alternative. And the reason for that is that most countries have not yet had a period of time in which socialists were able to erect the kind of system, the alternative that they had talked about, so that the world could see. Now, there are important exceptions. In 1917, a revolution in Russia brought in socialists who, for the next 70 years, ran a society, so we could begin to say, okay, here's what socialists will do. And likewise, in the People's Republic of China, a revolution there, in finishing and succeeding in 1949, ushered in a group of people who are socialists, were socialists then, and have continued to support and endorse socialism as an alternative to capitalism right through to the present. So we have another more than half a century of experience in China to see what it means. And then there were a bunch of other countries in Eastern Europe, places like Cuba, Vietnam, and so on, where socialists were able to win power either through elections or through violent revolutions or through other kinds of political shifts. So we have some experience, and there is some of socialism, which is an alternative that we can point at and look at to get a sense. But let's go back to what socialism mainly was. It was a critique of capitalism which basically went this way, that capitalism is a system that develops the means of production. It is technologically progressive. Every capitalist is driven by the pressures of competition to constantly look for new and cheaper ways of producing. Otherwise, he or she is competed out of existence. So there's a kind of hysterical pressure to grow, to technologically innovate. That's very interesting. Capitalism has certainly succeeded in being technologically dynamic. But, says the socialist, this economic technological dynamism has come at an enormous price. What are the prices? The socialist points to, number one, a fundamental tendency towards deep inequality, towards producing extremes of wealth at one end of society and poverty, depredation, hard times for masses of people, the vast majority, at the other end. Even though periodically the people rise up and say it's not tolerable and force adjustments, the underlying mechanisms of capitalism produce social inequality, beginning with economic inequality, and the rich then buy the political system to make sure it doesn't undo the inequality that the economy enabled them to achieve. And pretty soon you have a class divided, economically, politically, and culturally divided society, and that has been, socialists argue, a tragedy for the human race, producing conflict, tension, war, and a whole host of other social ills. There are other critiques socialism makes, but they really are derivative of this notion of the fundamental inequality and bad social relationships that capitalism tends towards. It is therefore, in their judgment, fundamentally unjust as a system, fundamentally anti-community, anti-union, anti-solidarity of people in communities, and therefore the human race can and should do better. In recent decades, socialists have been much taken also with the criticisms of capitalism coming from environmentalists, who point out that another problem of capitalism is its fundamental disrespect for nature, its notion that nature is something to be overcome, dominated, and controlled, with the result of a level of degradation of our environment, damage to our health, our ecological systems, and so on. How do socialists account for capitalism's shortcomings in this development of their own ideas and their own socialist movement? They argue that there are two qualities of capitalism that account for the parts of its results that are so tragic and that we can and should do better than as a human race. The first is the private ownership of means of production. What they mean by that is that capitalism is a system that celebrates private individuals owning the land, the stores, the offices, the factories, the businesses of a society. We all depend on the goods and services our economy produces, but we permit the enterprises that produce those goods and services to be owned and controlled by a tiny minority. The shareholders, the major shareholders who own these things, and the boards of directors that those owners select to run them. These are tiny minorities of our people, and the socialist critique here becomes very simple. If you allow a tiny minority of the society to own and control the enterprises that produce goods and services, they will use them, they will make the decisions that go with ownership and control to advantage themselves at the expense of the majority of people. Or to say the same thing another way, the socialists argue, if you want the economy, the productive enterprises that produce the goods and services we all depend on, if you want that economy to serve the people, then the people have to own them and the people have to run them. And the only agency, socialists typically argue, that can act as the owner-operator in the name of and subordinate to the people is a government that is genuinely a government by and of the people. So socialists have tended to say we shouldn't have private enterprise, we should have state enterprise. The government, for and on behalf of the people, should own and operate the economic enterprises. The second argument socialists have traditionally made is that capitalism uses a peculiar institution to distribute the goods and services it produces, and indeed to distribute the resources needed to produce those goods and services. The institution capitalism relies on is the market. And in the market, the person who gets the resources, the person who gets the products, is the person with the most money. That's how markets work. If there's a shortage of goods compared to those who want them compete to get the goods by offering ever higher prices for them. That's what a market is, and that's what a market does. So that what markets do is deliver resources and products into the hands of people according to how much money they have. And the socialists argue that that is not an appropriate way of doing it. What that does is, predictably, concentrate resources and concentrate the output of goods and services in the hands of the richest folks, who then control the politics and the culture, and there we are again. If we want a community of people who know and care, trust and love one another, well, then we cannot distribute it that way, because the market tends to favor those who have money and therefore are in a position to grow even richer because they can get what the market has. And it tends to deprive those who don't have money, regardless of the reason why they don't, from access to the resources and goods that will ever get them out of their economic difficulty. In other words, markets solidify economic differences, and since capitalism as a system of production produces extremes of wealth, the market simply perpetuates that. And so socialists have said that the inequality, the unjust nature of capitalism, the tensions that ride it, the unfairness of it all, the burdensome of life for so many while a tiny minority spends $74 million on a co-op apartment in New York City, in terms of what we said earlier, that the solution, the socialists say, is to remove private enterprise and substitute state enterprise, and to remove the market as the distribution mechanism for resources and goods, and instead have the government plan them, distribute the goods according to what the society needs. If we need less inequality, well, then distribute the goods that way. If we need to offset disadvantage of poor people in schools, well, then distribute the resources that way. If we want to stimulate innovation by creative people, then distribute some. But take all of these goals that a society has, democratically discuss them, get a priority amongst them, and then distribute accordingly. Markets don't do that, but planners, government planners, might. So what socialists did is say, we want to change. We want to go from private to state ownership and operation of enterprises, and from markets to planning. That way, we will get a society more just, more efficient in terms of using its resources for what its society genuinely wants, and less of a mechanism to make and keep a minority rich and powerful. When socialists succeeded in places like Russia, China, and so on, basically, that's what they did. They took industry away from its private owners and made those into state enterprises, state industries. And they subordinated markets. They never got rid of markets altogether. That's a fantasy of folks who don't know the history. But what they did do was subordinate the markets. There would be markets, but government planners would control what the prices were and would basically manipulate markets to get the kind of outcome that they thought society needed and wanted. Capitalists watched all of this in horror. They watched in horror that the Russian Revolution took that big country out of the world capitalist orbit and put it under the wing of people who were anti-capitalist, who were socialist. And they were horrified after World War II when that happened in China. Russia is the largest country on earth by land mass, and China is the largest country on earth by population. So you had the two largest countries now in a different place. And so capitalists reacted. And here's what they found. They had certain advantages in fighting socialism. First, that socialism arrived in countries that were much, much poorer than where capitalism had been for 200 years. This little detail was kind of brushed under the rug. And instead, what capitalists did was to juxtapose the relatively high standard of living of working people in North America, Western Europe, and Japan, on the one hand, against the poverty of Russians and Chinese on the other. This wasn't quite fair, since socialism hadn't had 200 years to develop the country, so you could compare what 200 years of socialism might have done in Russia and China against what 200 years of capitalism had in fact done in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, but it was an effective counterattack. The second way capitalism counterattacked was by threatening the socialists in Russia and China with nuclear and military annihilation. The United States, but also the Western Europeans, and to some degree the Japanese, circled Russia and then China with military bases, pointed missiles at them, terrified them, and that was a clever strategy because it forced Russia and China, poor countries whose major goal was to develop their economies and especially to become showcases of what socialism could do, they couldn't devote the resources minimum as they were to that, because they had to devote enormous amounts of their resources to military parity with the West that was threatening them. And so that slowed down their economic development, and therefore that made it harder for them to compete on the level of standard of living. And the third thing that happened in the struggle of the capitalists against the emerging socialists was that the capitalists noticed that in socialist economies, the state was given so much power, power to run industry, power to distribute goods and services, that in a sense, the government became all-powerful. And so the Western capitalist countries could go to their working class and say, you know those socialists? They're giving so much power to the government that the average citizen has very little power. And you know, this was true enough. The average citizen didn't have much power in the way these socialist economies were set up. And so it became a very effective argument that the socialists, whatever they may do for their people economically, the folks are not free. And that, together with they don't have a very high standard of living, was enough to convince a huge number of workers in capitalism that whatever their critique of capitalism might be, in those socialist economies erected by the socialists, workers were living at a much lower standard of living and seemed to have less of the civil liberties and freedoms that were at least typical to many, if not all, of the countries of Western Europe, North America, and Japan. So the question for the socialists was, what do you do in this situation? You could, of course, stay with the idea that what socialists are and do is to give the government a bigger role. But if you did that, government running enterprises, or maybe government just regulating them, and government planning overshadowing markets, if you did that, you would be pushing something which the capitalists had pretty well inoculated their working classes against. Not only that, you'd be reproducing the very overpowerful central government that proved such a problem in Stalin's Russia, but in a number of other socialist economies, thereby fueling the very problem that capitalists had been using so successfully to marginalize the socialists. What to do in that situation? Well, basically, socialists around the world are dividing amongst each other as they struggle with how to respond, how to reignite the socialist movement. And before I tell you in my conclusion for today where that's going, let me remind you that socialism remains the shadow critic of capitalism. In the first 200 years, it proved to be very, very powerful. From a relatively small number of people being critical of capitalism when it begins in the 18th century in Britain, and as it grows to dominance in the 19th century in Europe and then North America and Japan, socialists also grew from small groups here and there to immense political movements that were able to sustain a trade union movement global in its scope. political parties, socialist parties, that are very important players in the political lives of many, many, many nations who have capitalist economies. No one should mistakenly sell the socialist movement short. It went from a very small number of people to a global movement. Many governments in the world today are either led by or include the representatives of socialist parties who get enormous proportions of the votes in those countries. Many of them are called socialist. Many of them are not, but support the basic socialist idea. So we're talking about a movement that was very successful, that then was problematized, challenged, if you like, by the counterattack of capitalism, particularly after World War II, where not only did capitalism make those critiques I pointed out, but capitalism had its own resurgence. First, the resurgence from World War II's destruction from 1945 to 1975, then the resurgence with neoliberalism, with deregulation, the Thatcher-Reagan revolution from 1975 to 2007. But that's over now. Capitalism has, as it always did, run itself into a global crisis of enormous proportions, second only to the catastrophe of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Socialists are discovering people turning against capitalism, questioning and challenging it across the world. This is a time when socialists have an opportunity, the likes of which they haven't had for half a century. The question is, can they break from the old idea, the state takes over production, the state takes over distribution, and come up with a new, a different, an adjusted kind of concept of socialism that would speak to all the disaffection that capitalism is generating around the world? That's the really big issue that socialists face. And when we get together next week, I will continue, because this both answers questions you have sent to me, but also deals with what is emerging as a fundamental conflict that will shake our societies in the years to come, and therefore deserve our attention now. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you as always. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. Please join me again next week.